It's a business model that made a lot of sense for a long time. Televisions were the focal point of living rooms, while the radio was a staple in the car. You tune into the local news during the supper hour, watched must-see TV during prime time on the cable networks, and switched on your local radio station on your commute to and from work. But all of that changed in the past decade. The growth of Twitter and Facebook meant people were getting their local news through push notifications and social media. Streaming services like Netflix paved the way for new platforms for entertainment, and streaming posed a threat to local radio stations. Local media, for the most part, worked on a very simple model. You have great content, mass audiences, and the result was local advertising, therefore revenue. The revenue was used to fund the station, pay people, and ideally create more great local content. But like many industries, this model is in dire need of a refresh. I'm Winston C, and in this episode of Staying Alive, we dive into the business of local media. What worked in the past, where things are evolving, and strategies for success from the perspective of a Canadian media executive. New content from new competition means advertisers are going elsewhere, often online. Changing consumption habits means content needs to evolve too. And for a business that's so dependent on volume, that leaves a fragile model of local television and radio in limbo. One Canadian media executive who's seen the industry through its ups, downs, and growing pains is Colette Watson. She's currently the president of CPAC and was most recently the senior vice president of TV operations at Rogers Media, a collection of properties including City TV, Omni Television, Rogers TV, among other brands like Sportsnet, KISS, and All News Radio. Colette, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Winston.
It's so lovely to have you on, and I think it's important to disclose off the top that I worked under you when I was at Breakfast Television. So first of all, it's great to reconnect with you, but it's also such an honor to have you on because of the amount of experience you've had in local media.
Well, it's an honor. We all had our own jobs, and television is a team effort, as you know, so we were all in it together.
Absolutely. And you've had a remarkable 30-year career at Rogers, a storied company, family company, and a company that's had very deep roots in media. And you've witnessed local media go through so many stages of growth. So I want to get going on a positive note. Regardless of platform, in your years of managing local media, local television, what is the one common thread in the local news and media business that drives its importance and success today?
Its name, just by definition, being local. So 30 years ago, the local news, local council, it was all about driving into the neighborhood information. Fast forward to the last decade, where all of a sudden we live in a mobile global society, you still want to come home. You still need to know if the schools are open, if the blizzard's going to hit your highway, if the garbage is going to get picked up or not. And everyone just wants to go home, even though the technology has made the world available to us. And, you know, if you talk to Elon Musk, the universe available to us, but you still want to know what's going on at home.
Now, something that's really interesting about local news, the experience that you have as a media executive, you know, on the kind of grassroots level, journalism is critically important. It's important to democracy. It's really important work. And then when you get to a media executive level, it becomes more of a difficult thing to look at. You have to understand the importance of journalism, but you're definitely looking at running it like a business. And at the end of the day, local newsrooms run on a very specific business model. So what are some of the challenges of finding that right balance? Because when you look at managing legacy media, television, radio, and then you kind of see these emerging platforms on the horizon, I imagine it's like hitting a moving target. There's a balance that's to be struck.
Completely and totally. And then add to that the fact that we are in Canada, in English Canada. For today, what I'm going to talk about is really the situation for English Canada. It's very different for French Canadians. But because we operate, we being in the television industry in English Canada, operate in the shadow of the U.S., it is doubly challenging. 30 years ago, it was a good business. Today, it is an impossible business. It doesn't make money. It doesn't make business sense. But the balance comes in, Winston, because it needs to get done, right? You have to do the right thing. You have to, cultural sovereignty and democracy. And this, I don't mean this to be hyperbolic, but they are at play here. And so as companies, regulated companies like Rogers, we understood that there is an importance there and we placed a priority on it. But because City had a different style, we also didn't carry a lot of older baggage in terms of how news gets done, where you send a reporter, a producer, a shooter, an audio guy, and sometimes it's a crew of four or five. Now we used to send you and a phone out to do things, right? And yes. So if you're willing to evolve and adapt, you could create news.
Yeah. And you know, when you look at what City is doing, what Rogers is doing, and then you go on the other side of the street and you see what Bell and what Corus is doing, they're following many of the same ways that City was doing things 5 years ago. They're starting to implement those now. And at the time, you received criticism from people for the City way, but you also received a lot of praise and a lot of recognition for it. You've had to make a lot of difficult decisions in your time at City.
I have. They were tough, tough years. When I was given the assignment, it was to stop the hemorrhaging of money in these. Now, audiences were fragmenting everywhere, whether you were watching primetime television or news. The audiences were fragmenting. That's what started, to your point earlier, of the money was based on ad revenue that is priced at a mass audience. And if your audience numbers start to go down, well, the audience, the advertising revenue starts to go down as well. And then you are left with less money to do the things you want to do, like a newscast or a show of some sort. So we did have to make tough, tough decisions. We had to get a lot of people on board and we had to let a lot of people go. And it was hard. You know, over the years, we had to make some really difficult decisions that impacted humans, right? These are humans we are talking about. It was meant to save the whole thing, right? While we may have lost 200 positions, we saved the other 1,000 positions. The reason behind it, keep doing news, change how you do it in order to stay relevant to our audiences and try and find a way to keep the stations on the air, which is what we did.
Do you believe that there's still power behind the brands, brands like City TV, brands like Omni Television, Breakfast Television, City Line, City News? Are those names still important names in a household?
Less than they were. So yes, they are. I don't know for how long though, Winston. I think personalities become brands, which is what we've seen in the world of influencers. And those are basically brands of another name, right? To stay relevant in television, you have to evolve your brands. And so influencers are, for lack of a better word, brands. And so if you follow along that way and you develop your brands along those lines, you should be okay. But brands, and I'll lump in social media influencers in that, absolutely are still very relevant today.
I think something that's really interesting too, you mentioned earlier that Canada lives in the shadow of the US. And in a lot of ways, and because television operates on a business of volume, Canada is kind of living what the US is going to see in the next few years. The US has the benefit of volume. There's so many more people, there's more money, there's the audiences are larger. So they've been able to keep these kinds of beasts going for a bit longer than Canada. But we're already starting to see the precursor to what Canada has already gone through with downsizing. When you look at American companies that own local stations, Sinclair, Hearst, they're all slashing and laying off people as well. And they're making very similar moves to what we've seen in Canada already.
They are. It's all about audience and bottom line in those instances, and the audience continuing to fragment. Their experience is different than ours, and it is my belief that a lot of that reduction right now or transfer of eyeballs is based on tribalism in the U.S. You know, a Sinclair Broadcasting Group actually has a reputation as being occupying a certain spot on the spectrum. You know, they are perceived as being a little bit right of center. And so if you feel you're a right of center voter, you're going to watch your Sinclair News versus NPR or a different brand. And that is drilling down to local, which it didn't do 10 years ago. Those were reserved for cable news. The difference between Canadian television is regulation from my perspective. And I started 30 years ago, but in 1984, Canadian regulation started to create what was called then a regulatory bargain with Canadian television licensed and cable companies to say, we operate in the shadow of the American empire of television. And so how do we protect our cultural sovereignty and how do we have Canadian voices heard? We wanted to make sure that there was Canadian news, Toronto news, Ottawa news, Winnipeg news, wherever you live, you want to have your local newscast. And so the regulatory bargain was created. And a lot of Canadians who are now, the fragmentation is, we've moved, what do I need to pay my cable company for? I'm just going to have it get it off Amazon or Netflix or a streaming service. But the end result of that is that's less money, because what a lot of people don't understand is that money doesn't go straight into, you know, the owner's pocket. 55 cents of every dollar that came in went out to these channels, whether it was the Weather Network or the Comedy Channel or pick a channel. And then 5% of those revenues went towards funding Canadian drama, the Canadian Media Fund. And then if you own television stations, 30% of your revenue had to go to spending on local news and local television, and 5% had to go on things called programs of national interest. So that's money and that's investment. We operated, and I was always proud to go to a CRTC hearing and quite proudly, boastfully, talk about what we did and what the teams did and what people like you did, Winston, and because we did darned good with the money we had compared to the news budgets. You know, the news budgets of an American, pick Buffalo, say, for example, four local news brands, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, it's whose helicopter is bigger than the other guys, right? They all had helicopters. They all had live crime reporters. And
whose radar is bigger.
Yes, exactly, right? What people are not understanding is the Broadcasting Act, super old, is now being debated, right? C-10 is being debated. And the whole issue was asymmetrical, right? If Amazon, Netflix, Google are going to come in, should they pay? How do they pay? How do we make it, fair?
News is almost forgotten. It's really purely to talk about the entertainment industry. Where is news in this conversation?
Yeah, and huge miss on, from my perspective. The independent production sector did a fantastic job lobbying, because it's really all about that. And okay, but I believe democracy is not well served if you don't have local news. And how do we fund local news if Amazon can come in and start, you know, selling you your Stack TV? They're not sending in 30 cents on every dollar to fund local news, right? How does news go forward, right? How do we go forward with news? Because let's just call it table stakes that news needs to exist. Subscription isn't going to cut it. Ad revenue is a fraction of a penny compared to what you would get off television. I don't have an answer to this. This is,
well, that's what the industry is trying to figure out right now.
Local, regional, national. Those are all super important, all equally as important. One doesn't take priority over the other. Is it tax credits? So personally, I thought it was tax credits. I spent my last 2 years at Rogers schlepping from bureaucrat to bureaucrat talking about tax credits.
And it requires cooperation with the CRTC. And that is something that you have worked very hard to understand, regulatory, and to have, like, you have sat in front of the CRTC many, many times to lobby for local. Can you speak a little bit about the importance of that relationship and why it's important to have a good relationship with the CRTC?
because we operate in a regulatory bargain, right? And I don't feel like we're compromised in any way by saying it that way. We all operate in the shadow of the U.S., and the commission and the government always have the mission of Canadian cultural sovereignty, creating a vibrant, healthy Canadian broadcast ecosystem. We're all bought in. We're all in on that. If you go in and say, I share your goals, first off, you have to build trust, right? And you have to be truthful and honest. And I always try to be pragmatic and say, let me translate what your position is. Let me translate that into operational impact. Okay, so if you do this, that means I would have to do it this way, and this is what the output would be. I'm going to say 10 years ago, there seemed to be a change where it was felt that industry was lobbying and too cozy with the CRTC, and then a wall went up where I can't call the director of broadcasting policy at the commission anymore and say, did you think about this when this would happen? And so I miss those frank conversations. That said, we made it a goal, an objective. We made it our policy to always be upfront with the commission, whether you're going to miss something or whether you're going to exceed something, but also always wanted to be partners with them. And so when we would appear before the commission, it was because we were honest and authentic leading up to that appearance that we were trusted. You know, if you've got a good idea that is based on not putting money in the shareholders' pocket, but keeping news alive, and you all come together and you say, okay, the world's changed. How do we keep news alive? Here's a way. What do you think of this way? And at that hearing, many people came with different ways. They chose that way. That's how we were able to launch City News outside of Toronto.
I've spent a lot of this last year studying the importance of diversity and representation in Canadian media. And you played a big role in the negotiation of the Omni 91H decision. And for people who don't know what that is, it's mandating the carriage and getting some subscriber fees so that the station can operate without that $40 million loss. So how important was that 91H to Omni Television? And where do you see the growth for ethnic media in Canada? It's probably not all in television.
The answer to your first question is it's existential. If 91H doesn't exist for Omni, Omni doesn't exist. I was a cog in the wheel that got that. Susan Wheeler was a huge driver of that win, so she deserves most of the credit for that. But we had to have three hearings on that, and everyone knew it was the right thing to do, but people just were scratching their heads going, oh, you can't have a company like Rogers be so altruistic. And we were. I was there when Ted bought Omni. He was really proud of having bought Omni. Omni, when he bought it, was one station. It was CFMT. You know, again, I'm old, so I sound old. Oh, Winston, I apologize for this. But, you know, the ancient history is he bought CFMT and was darn proud of it. And it was a good station that was supported by offering English language programming in certain times of the day. And that made all the money to spend on everything else. But when the English language programming when strip programming started to lose its allure, that's when the bottom started falling out of Omni, and that's when the newscasts had to get cut. And so we thought, all right, there's a way to do it. We went a total 180 on it. We will go 100% ethnic media in Omni, but we can't afford to do it. This is how it's to be done with the 91H, which means all Canadian cable subscribers have to pay for it. Again, the cable industry comes to the support of ethnic media in Canada. Ethnic media has room to grow, but like local news on different platforms, huge audience waiting across, you know, if you build it, they will come. The problem is we can't afford to build it.
When you go overseas and you take a look at news operators, digital-only, digital-born news operators in Hong Kong and Taiwan, for example, they are also picking up traction in Canada because in a lot of ways, people want to know what's going on back home, if you will.
The others are underwritten by investors who are willing to absorb losses for a while. How long they absorb them, to be determined. And so Canadian broadcasters were absorbing those losses. When I came on board, Citi had been losing money for years. Omni had been losing money for years. At some point, the investors say, we can't absorb these losses anymore. That's where we're at now. And so huge demand, huge need, huge public service obligation almost to have these and to offer these services. It's how do we fund them? I believe tax credits are the way. You know, if you look at recent rulings in Australia with respect to Facebook and local news, perhaps we look at something like that. I don't know.
From a business perspective, we've seen, you mentioned it earlier, subscription models, advertisement supported. There's no one size fits all approach, and there's no magic formula as to how this is done. But I guess there's a conversation, an important conversation to be had as to who should be somewhat responsible for the creation and the distribution of this vital, critical, this vital information that's important to not only physical communities, but ethnic cultural communities as well. And, you know, maybe that does involve a conversation with big tech, as we've seen in Australia with Facebook. Google, of course, has also stepped forward and they've expressed some interest in at least launching initiatives to support local journalism, but there hasn't been any commitment from a dollar perspective, if you will, to fund the production of that local news.
Agreed. And I have my own biases against creating an architecture of funds, right, which is a bureaucracy in and of itself, and then taking some of that money, which should be going to newsrooms, and spending it on the bureaucracy of that fund. If you look at around the world, whether it's space exploration or news, billionaires have decided to step up. Elon Musk is exploring space. Jeff Bezos is underwriting the Washington Post. And I'm sure he's not making money, but he's doing it out of the goodness of his heart. But that's dangerous, right? Right now, it's great because we see it as unbiased and objective. But where's the guarantee, right? And so that's where regulation had come in over the past few decades. Because at the end of the day, we come back to where we started, which is how do you protect the integrity of journalism, which is unbiased, fact-based reporting of events.
Absolutely. How do you want to see public policy support the growth and development of local journalism? You talked a little bit about having more open dialogue with leaders at the CRTC. How else do you want to see public policy support local news?
I would have loved a more robust place in the discussion of C10 on local news. I would love to see cable companies and broadcast distributors in the regulated Canadian system be recognized for the role they played in bringing us and continue to bring us local news that is underwritten by them, and some sort of, you know, acknowledgement and appreciation of that, and then a continued discussion of how can we, and I'm going to use a word you used earlier in the discussion, collaborate to keep this thing alive, because it's so important to keep local news alive.
Absolutely. Communication, collaboration, those are so key right now as we try to refresh a system that's really dated. When you look at the CRTC 20 years ago, it really was just English and French language, but now there is so much more, and we really need to reflect the audiences in which we serve, and the fabric of Canada today is so different. The landscape today is really different, so we need to make sure that we keep up with the times. And on that note, Colette, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. As you know, journalism is a critical part of democracy, but it's also one that requires so much funding to operate. And it's helpful to understand the intricacies and the role public policy has in fostering this critical work.
It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Colette Watson is a Canadian media executive and currently the president of CPAC. And in the next episode, we speak with Jeff Elgee. He's the head of Village Media, to talk about his digital-first approach and his publications across Canada, as well as how legacy media can employ some of these strategies. Thanks for joining us. I'm Winston C.